The KM Football Podcast. Exclusive interviews with the biggest names in Kent football.
Welcome to this week's KM Football Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Panting, and as always, I'm joined in the studio by Steve Turvett of the KM Sports Desk. My guest this week studied his career with Arsenal, but never actually made a first-team appearance for the Gunners. He joined Bournemouth before making his way onto the scene in Kent with a three-year spell at Dover. 3 years at Welling followed before a brief spell with Greys. Dartford was his next destination, only for Welling to appoint him as player manager at the tender age of 30 in 2009. After guiding the Wings to the Conference South title in 2013, he kept them in non-league's top flight before departing for Ebbsfleet at the end of 2014. Stonebridge Road was only home for 6 months, however, and another managerial spell with Braintree lasted even shorter. He was back at Welling for a brief stint before joining Gillingham as Ady Pennock's assistant, but now, in a first for the podcast, he's in charge of an international team. So a warm welcome to the first time for our international listeners, our guest Steve, to the Bangladesh national team coach, Jamie Day. Jamie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Good to see you. Let's talk Bangladesh first. You've been national team coach for a year now. How have you found that experience?
Yeah, it's been a fantastic experience to live in another country and work with different players and different mentalities has been a fantastic learning curve. So, you know, in that time we've had Olympics, Asian Olympics, which was very good, and two Asian championships in that time. So it's been a fantastic experience and learning curve.
How did the move come about? Because I dare say, you know, if you've been assistant manager at Barrow and Gillingham before that, how do you end up in Bangladesh?
Yeah, my friend is an agent in Australia, and he messaged me to say, look, the Bangladesh national job is coming up. Would you be interested? So I sort of said, yeah, no worries. I'm more than happy to do it. I hadn't spoke to family or anything and wife. And then out of the blue, they said, can you go to London and meet the president? And we had a chat for about an hour or so. And then they offered me the job. But obviously, I hadn't told my wife that this was maybe going to happen. So she was fantastic with it. And we both felt there was a good opportunity for me to, you know, work abroad, which I wanted to do, and with a national team.
Yeah, so I guess those opportunities don't come around too often. What, there's 211 teams that play international football?
You know, to manage a national team, you know, doesn't happen, you know, to managers that have managed non-league and the lower leagues in England. So, yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity. And, you know, so far I'm glad that, you know, that I've done it and took that risk to go out there and manage.
You mentioned your wife. Is the biggest challenge of this job being away from the family?
Yeah, I think it's difficult. You know, obviously I've got four children and spend 6 to 8 weeks, sometimes longer, in Bangladesh without seeing them. So it is tough on me, and it's tough on my wife and children. You know, she has to look after them and maintain, you know, making sure they're all right and the house and looking after everything. So she's been fantastic in that side of it, but it does, you know, it does take its toll.
Give us an insight into what life is actually like for you over there, both in terms of the job, the football, but just your day-to-day.
Yeah, so obviously the job is like any national team job. I get the players when we have friendlies or a tournament, and it's slightly different in Bangladesh. If we have a game, then we'll have a training camp for 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks before that game or tournament. So that would be day-to-day training, you know, and looking after the players. If there's no competition going on, then I'll watch their league out there, which is based over 3 days. They play at the same ground, and I'll stay and watch them games. And then, you know, the rest of it is sitting in a hotel and planning what we're going to do going on, which obviously can get a bit boring. So that's the difficult times as well, when you're sitting in a hotel and you've not got much to do. So, yeah, it's when there's things on, it's a fantastic job. You know, when you're involved in tournaments and you're playing against international managers and you're, you know, pitting your wits against them, it's fantastic. And they're the good points that you have to take and keep you going whilst you have the lows out there.
Can you paint a picture of the area where you're based, where you live?
Yeah, so I live in the city centre, which is Dhaka. Very high populated place. I think there's like 40 million people in that area, and it's very busy, very hectic, lots of traffic, the most traffic I've ever seen, you know. But they are very lovely people, very nice people. Can't do enough for me and my staff, and you know, I've had lots of meetings and meals with people I've never met before, but that's the type of people they are. So yeah, it's a very, very busy, hectic place to be in.
they're cricket mad, aren't they, in Bangladesh? So where does football sort of sit in their society?
Yeah, I think football is higher than cricket in Bangladesh. There's more people that play football, but obviously the cricket is higher because they're doing so well, and there's more money invested in cricket now because of the success they've had. But I think if you went over to Bangladesh, football is the number one sport. It's just unfortunate of where they are in the rankings, or where we are in the rankings, and how the league has declined a little bit, that people have took a step back. And obviously that's what we're trying to do now, is get them up the rankings and promote football again with being successful, and get the crowds back and get people, you know, supporting football again.
Tell us about the first time you stood in front of the players, called a meeting, or got your squad together. I mean, how did you communicate with them? What did you do?
So the first time I went out to a training camp that was already started. The technical director is English, so I met him out there, and my assistant is English as well. And we have two Bangladesh coaches, so we watched the first couple of days just to see what level they're at, and you know what they can and can't do, and. You know, the first couple of months and the first couple of meetings, first meeting, I would have a translator. So I would, you know, speak, and then translator would follow up what I say, which can be difficult because at the time I didn't know the translator. He didn't know how I worked. So he didn't know whether what I was saying and my point was getting across in how I wanted it to get across. And you have to trust the translator you've got. And the translator I have now is fantastic. He knows what I want and how we do it. So I have no issues with that. But it was tough to start with because obviously I don't know what he was saying to them, and you know we were doing sessions and he would speak in Bengali and I wouldn't actually know what he was saying. He could be saying the opposite. But as time goes on, then you work out the stuff, and he's been really good.
Do you feel you've been able to make progress in terms of how the team's played and also in building relationships with those players?
Yeah, you know, I think over the year we've made steady progress. We've climbed up the rankings. We made history in a couple of competitions. I think the first thing we noticed when we went in was fitness was a major key. You know, their diet at the start wasn't very good. It was lots of curries and dal and foods that were not good for them. And they were just organisation. They didn't have no organisation. They played like they was playing in a park. And they were the two things we identified. And then we put in a structure of how we wanted to play. And in fairness to the group of players that we've had majority of the players for 10 months. We haven't really changed the squad too much. They never went in the gym when we first met them. Now they're in the gym. They eat the right foods. They make sure they have the right protein drinks, and you know, they do everything properly now, and they've benefited from that. You know, if you look at the physique when we had them at the start till now, it's completely changed. You know, you can see the difference. They've all got no fat, got six packs, and it is a credit to them because they've bought into what we was telling them to do, and they've kept that going and they've maintained that, and they've got results from doing that.
How have people taken to you in terms of the support of someone coming in from overseas to manage the team and do things maybe a slightly different way?
Yeah, I think in general, I think everyone, you know, from the president down and the public have been very supportive. And it, like in anything in football, if you win games, then obviously that helps. And we've done reasonably well over the year. So people have, you know, liked the ideas that we've put across and what we've done and how we've change things to the team. I think with Bangladeshi people, they want a team that, whether it wins or loses, that gives 100% and they keep running and they keep trying and it's maximum effort. I think in the past, players haven't done that in Bangladesh and been a bit lazy. And they now see a team that is a young team. You know, I think majority of the team is under 22 that fights for 90 minutes and will keep going and have grinded out some good results and are happy with how they're playing.
So you're in a high-profile role in a densely populated country. Has that brought a level of kind of fame, celebrity with it?
It obviously is different to over here. You know, there's 160 million people in Bangladesh, and you know, so when you do get interviewed and when you are on TV, there's a lot more people that see it. And because of being, you know, sport, and they love sport in Bangladesh, you are seen a lot in the street and you get stopped and you have selfies, and it's obviously completely different over here. No one has a clue who I am, but over there...
Has that been strange? Do you enjoy that side of it?
Yeah. I'm not going to moan about it. I mean, if you go, you know, wherever we go out, then there'll be people there, there'll be pictures taken. And, you know, you like that. It's something that I've never had before and might never, ever get again. So I think for me, it's been a fantastic thing to happen, and happens to all the English staff over there. And yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Is it a job you want to continue doing?
I think with the World Cup year, I think that would be for me to manage in a World Cup qualifying game and have the chance of going into to the World Cup group stages. I think that's something that any coach would like to do, you know. So that's something I am looking forward to if, you know, we can agree that we get right things put in place for me to see my family a bit more. So that's something we'll discuss over the next few weeks.
Where did your love of coaching come from in the first place?
I think when I was a player, from young, I liked to see what the coach was doing and watch his sessions, and I'd always make notes of sessions that the coach has done, you know, and I always wanted to be a coach when I finished playing. And I started, you know, I'd done under sevens to start with, just to, you know, get the experience and get my badges. And I worked in Charlton Community Scheme, which was fantastic. You know, I'd done their local sports centres. But obviously I was still playing. I knew that I had an opportunity if I kept playing a level that we was playing at non-league, that a job might come up in that area. So it was something that I'd wanted to do, and, you know, just wait for that chance to happen.
Which managers most inspired you or impressed you with the way that they did coach?
Yeah, I think the best coach I've probably had is Don Howe. I think that his enthusiasm and his knowledge of the game, even when he was older, was fantastic. You know, every day he came into training, there was a smile on his face. He was lively. He wanted to get the best out of you. You know, he was fantastic. I was overweight at Arsenal when I was younger, and, you know, he didn't have to do it. He pulled me in, and for 6-8 weeks, he stayed with me every afternoon to make sure I got my weight down. And he did that, and that was, he didn't have to, you know. And, you know, his knowledge of football and tactics and how we see the game was the best that I've ever spoke to someone about.
How do you reflect on that period, starting off at Arsenal and then later with Bournemouth, that those early years of your playing career?
Yeah, I think a bit disappointed that, in a way, you know, I let myself down at them times. I think that when I joined Arsenal, I was in a good position. You know, I'd come from national school, I played for England, and I think I got lazy, and I think that I stopped doing the things that I'd done to get me in that position and put me in a good position, and didn't work as hard as I should have. And don't get me wrong, Arsenal were a fantastic team. The chances of probably getting the first team was slim, but I had been one of the best players going into Arsenal at that time, and I didn't follow that through, and I didn't continue to progress like I did. And, you know, and I got to a stage at Arsenal where I knew I wasn't going to get in the first team, and felt it was best that I moved. Bournemouth come in and bought me from to go there. And then again, I think I thought League One was going to be easy. I thought I was going to drop down, be there for 6 months, stroll it, and then go back up to playing it. And it wasn't, you know. It was tough league. It was different football. It was more physical. We didn't get a lot of time on the ball. And, you know, I went into League One where winning games, that was people's livelihoods. That was people's jobs, playing for reserves and 23s. Results are not, it's about performance. And I didn't do that well enough at Bournemouth, and played, you know, 30 games, whatever, over 3 years. And you know, again, it was no one else's fault other than my own.
Do you have regrets then about that, you know, that time where you think, well, what if I'd really cracked it at Arsenal, there was a chance to play?
Yeah, you know, I remember being younger and people would say, don't be one of them players when look back and go, if I'd have worked a little bit harder, if I'd have done this. And I was like, no, it won't never be me, it won't be me. And it was. It was, you know, I look back now and I had a fantastic opportunity to, you know, play at a higher level. And because of me not doing things correctly, it didn't happen. And yeah, I have regrets, but I also look at that was maybe, you know, the pathway that I went, I enjoyed that as well, and I loved playing non-league football. I loved, you know, being around that environment. So there's ups and downs. I think I'm always going to have some regrets about that I should have done a lot more than I did, but, you know, as I say, it's only myself to blame for that.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
When you talk about the move into non-league football, Dover was the first stop, wasn't it? How did that come about, and how much do you enjoy your time there?
Yeah, Bournemouth played Dover in a LDV Vans, I think it was then, and Bill was the manager, I think, and I got released at the end of that season, and Bill rang me up and said, you know, look, would you come down No, Bill went to Kingstonian, actually, and Bill rang me and said, would I go to Kingstonian, but he left a list of players at Dover, that he wanted to sign. And Gary Bellamy come in and he see the list and rung me up and said, look, I've never seen you play. Bill had this list. We're in a conference. Kingstonian was running Premier. Would you come down and have a chat? So I had a chat, and Dover was a nice stadium, and it was going to part-time, which I'd never done before, but I thought that it was a nice club to be at to try and get back into trying to be a league player again. So, you know, I went that way towards Dover. And the first year was a struggle. Again, you know, I didn't play particularly well in the first year. We got relegated and started the season and then dropped out and become more of a sub, if I'm honest, in the first year. And I remember Bill come back with Clive, and Clive Walker pulled me one day and said, look, if you don't liven yourself up, you're going to end up going out the game and you end up playing in the park on Sunday. And I think that was a bit of a wake-up call that I needed. In the next 2 years, you know, I had really good 2 years at Dover. The next year, you know, one player of the year, we come third in the league and scored 14 goals, I think. So, yeah, I had a good 2 years at Dover and really enjoyed it.
Did it take a bit of getting your head around going part-time because it was a different way of living and playing?
Yeah, I went from, that was my job as a professional footballer, to then part-time job, which was a quarter of the money that I was getting as a professional, and I had a mortgage, and I had to get another job, and I'd never had a job, you know, I'd never worked. So for me to then just suddenly drop out and need to pay bills and mortgages, there was not a lot I could do, you know. So luckily I'd done a bit of coaching and I'd got some badges and a job come up at Charlton, and that was the route that, you know, for me, I decided to go down.
Does part of you almost wish that the Clive Walker chat had happened a few years earlier when you still were in the pro game?
I think even if that would have happened, I still at that time in the pro game thought that I was doing enough and that I didn't need that chat, you know. But, you know, Clive was spot on, you know. He was a very good manager for me. I enjoyed playing for Clive, gave me confidence and probably got the best out of me for a long time as a player. But yeah, I think my attitude and my mentality at pro level was that I'm doing enough, and it wasn't until we drop out of that and then I realised that, you know, I need to pull my socks up and I need to, if I want to play football at a decent enough level, then I need to start performing and need to start doing the right things.
Is one of the worst things in that scenario almost seeing other players that you were playing alongside, and many maybe thought you were better at, say, 16, 17, actually going on and having good careers in the game?
Yeah, well, if you look, when I was at National School, you know, it was Michael Owen, Wes Brown, Michael Ball, you know, there was players that went on and had fantastic careers, and even the ones that didn't have played in the Premiership, played League One, played League Two, and, you know, it is disappointing that I didn't do that, but, you know, they knuckled down and they kept going and they didn't let things get them down when it didn't go to plan. So I'm pleased for them because, you know, they're friends, and, you know, I like want people to do well, and there's no one else to blame other than me not doing well.
Where do you think you played your best football?
I think that I enjoyed playing with Clive. I enjoyed the season with AD. I think that was a good year. If I'm honest, I probably think my best playing time was when I was a manager. And I probably know the reasons why that is, because obviously I had a free reign to do what I wanted, and I knew when I didn't play well and I knew when I played well, but I knew that I had to play well to keep the other players' levels up, and I knew that I couldn't drop my standards. So for me, probably coming towards 28, 29 onwards to 31, say, I think that's probably where I was most confident and knew I had to play well to keep everyone else going.
Was that as much knowing your own game by then as anything else?
Yeah, I think over the years as a player, I think I was one of them players that was always on the fringe at Bournemouth, especially. I was on the fringes of in the first team and would play one or two games, and then when I didn't play very well, I'd be dropped. And I needed, just me personally, I needed to have a manager that, like an AD or a Clive, that believed in me, that not I was the main man, but someone that I knew if I didn't play well, go, don't worry about it, it's all right, next game be fine, and I could get myself going again and get back on to playing well. When you're a manager yourself, then I know, you know, when I've played well and I've not played well. And I also think when you're player manager, you think less about your game because you're worrying about everyone else. So I would just play. I wouldn't worry about this and that and who I'm playing against. I would just go, right, he needs to play well, he needs to play well. So I'll just go out and do what I needed to do.
When you left Dover, you went to Welling. Paul Parker was manager at the time.
Yeah.
How did that move come about?
The league split, and you had to finish in the top 12 or 15, I can't remember what it was, and we didn't do that with Dover in the second year, and Welling did, and obviously Welling's like 2 minutes from my house, so Paul rang me up and said, you know, he spoke to a few of the Dover players, I think Lee Spiller and Tony Brown, Andy Arnott, I think, as well, and he said, look, I want to take the bulk of the boys, would you come over as well, and we had a chat and felt that that was a good move for me at that time.
How did you find Paul as a manager?
I thought Paul was a good person. I don't think he was strong enough as a manager to get what he needed to get out of the players. I think that he was probably too nice. And it with the group of players that we had, it needed someone to be on them players all the time to get the best out of them. And I think that Paul probably didn't do that, but I can't fault him off the pitch as a person because I thought he was a really nice bloke.
Was you still making these notes, that sort of, you know, the coaching black book almost at the time?
Yeah, every coach and manager that I've played under, I will have sessions on that coach and manager and also how they managed and how they coached, good and bad, because, you know, you have to look at both sides of it. When I don't agree with what a manager's done in the past, I have to look at me not doing that to players that I've had and how I felt when that manager done that to me. And so, yeah, I mean, that will keep going. And even when we go on courses now and you speak to other managers, I'll make notes and how they do things and look at it, whether I think that's what I would do or wouldn't do, and you make your own judgments from that.
And when you was at Welling the first time, that's when you first came across AD Pennock?
Yeah, so Paul left and then AD come in, and I hadn't really known AD before that, and he come in, and he was a manager that you wanted to play for, that you would throw your body in front of a ball and in the line to stop it, because he had a line of expectation of what he wanted, but because he made you feel that... you know, you should want to play for him. And I really enjoyed playing for AD. We built up a good relationship. I think that he only stayed 1 or 2 years, I'm not sure, 2 years, yeah. But for me, them 2 years, I really enjoyed. And Phil, you know, Phil Hanford was fantastic as well, good coach, and very enjoyable 2 years for me.
How did he give you that feeling of wanting to put your body on the line for him?
I think AD was one of them that he would do anything for you as long as he was getting it back in return. And again, you know, I've worked with AD quite a few times, so he's a fantastic person. He's someone that will do whatever he can for you on and off the pitch. And I think every player, you know, at that time at Welling and further on, is knows what you're going to get with AD. You know what's expected. You know that he will do whatever he can for you, so you feel that, you know, you don't want to let him down. You feel that you, when you go out and play, you're playing for yourself, but you're playing for him, and you want him to win as much as you want to win as well. And I think, you know, he, like I say, he's for me, he's been fantastic.
So he's more than just your boss on the football field. If things you needed a hand with something away from the game as well, he'd be there.
Yeah, anything. If it was family, you know, and there was issues with your family, you know, you could ring him up. And a lot of managers, you can't do that. You know, in the past, I've had managers where I would be scared to speak to them. You know, and for him to be able to, for you to know that you could pick up a phone and he's there and you can call him, then, you know, I think that gives you confidence as well.
After Welling, it was Grays, wasn't it?
And yeah.
Sort of in and out a bit there.
Yeah, Grays was a funny club. It was full-time, which is the draw for me to go there, and Justin was there. And I think at the time the chairman had an influence on who played and who didn't play, and... The first year, I think for me, I always seem to struggle going to somewhere new the first year of settling in and getting used to the environment. And first year, played, I don't know, probably half the games in that. And then the second year, I had a fallout with Mickey, the chairman. And I basically trained on my own for 6 months, you know, and would just ring in. And he would say, come training or don't come training. And that was how we'd done it for a period of time. And then, you know, they said, right, go out on loan. So I went out on loan, come back, then, you know, basically carried on training. And then I think Dartford, spoke to Tony at Dartford and knew that, you know, I had to get out and went to Dartford.
So although it was a drop down to go to Dartford, was it a bit of a relief to start afresh there?
Yeah, it was, you know, like I say, towards the end I wasn't training. I was basically either ringing up to say, can I come in to train? And if he said yes, then I'd come in and train on my own next to a pitch next to the players. And, you know, that's not a nice situation to be in. So when Dartford, Dad, new stadium, I knew Tony was my dad's friend. And I'd known Tony a very long time. And I knew what he was trying to do at Dartford. And it was a good club to go to.
So what was he like to play for?
Yeah, I liked playing for Tone. Again, I thought very good person, very honest, had a way he wanted to play, and everyone knew that way. I enjoyed training, and I enjoyed my time at Dartford as well. You could see that it was a club that was going to progress and that was going to go forward. And I wasn't there very long, but I had a good time there when, you know, playing for Tony.
The second season was obviously the one when they went on and won the Ryman Premier title. Yeah. But you left in November, and I think probably a lot of people raised eyebrows when you went and took a manager's job and sort of turned your back on that. So how and why did that happen?
Yeah, I think at Dartford that time, I think we started the season really well. I think we'd won 7 or 8 on the bounce, whatever it was. And I think, you know, you could see that we had a squad that was good enough to win that league. But I always wanted to manage, and I always wanted, if the opportunity came, then I would look at it and see if it was the right decision. And whilst at Dartford we was doing really well, and I felt that we had a good enough team to get up, when I spoke to Piggy and Barry, you know, and it was in the league above then, and I liked Welling before, you know, my kids, you know, liked Welling, and it was a place that I felt at home at. I jumped at the chance to go back because, one, it was managing, and two, it was a club that I knew everyone there, and I knew the environment, and I knew that, you know, for me, it was a good place to start.
So was it something you initiated? You kind of made the contact with them?
No, I think that Piggy spoke to me and said, would you be interested? And because I speak to Piggy all the time. Even when I left, I still spoke to Piggy and Barry, and we had a little chat. And then I went and see Tone, and I said to Tone, look, there's an opportunity. Is it possible? And he was good as gold. And he said, look, you know, I think you're too young to do this. I think you can play for another 3, 4, 5 years and then do that. But I thought, you know, this opportunity might not come again for me to be able to do that. And Dartford were fantastic to get the deal done. And then me to start Welling.
And the playing and managing, it worked for you, didn't it?
Yeah, I had fantastic staff, you know, Ash and Frosty. I knew that when I was playing, they had, you know, say of what they wanted to do and make subs if they felt they needed to, or shout something on the pitch. So I was lucky that I could just go out and play and help the players on the pitch, and they could worry about things that they might see off the pitch. You know, Frosty and Ash both coach, so at times I could step out from the coaching during training and just worry about keeping fit and ticking over. So I had a really good staff that were key to that as well.
And interesting that you said almost as a byproduct of being the manager, you didn't overthink your playing and it just came a bit more naturally.
Yeah, I think for me, I found it easier just to go out and play, and I didn't have to worry about other things. All I worried about when I was going out to play is making sure the players that I were playing with, I was keeping them on their toes, and me being close to them on the pitch, I could do that. You know, I couldn't shout a player from the side and they go, I can't hear you, what you're saying. I was there next to them, so I could constantly keep on at them. And I didn't have to worry about my game then. I was just worrying about everyone else's and trying to, as a manager, you want to win as many games as you can. So all I was worried about was winning and making sure the other boys were doing their best for us to do that.
Well, at times when they made subs on the sidelines and you sort of stand in the middle of the pitch thinking, oh, I wouldn't have done that. I don't know what I'd done that for.
Yeah, only when they sub me. a couple of times, I'd always said to them, look, you've got a free rein. If you see something, no problem. You know, we had that closeness where they could say what they wanted to me, you know, in a dressing room, in closed doors, and I would listen to anything they said and I would make the decision on what we wanted, but they knew they could say anything. And if I felt they made a sub, sometimes I would shout back from the pitch, no, don't do it. But in general, if they felt a sub was needed, then I would go with that, because I sometimes get caught up in your playing and worrying about everyone else on the pitch. They can see other things. So very rarely, I think maybe once or twice, I said, I don't want the sub to be made. Other times, you know, we had a bit of a plan at certain times in the games. If things didn't work out, we'd do this, this and this. So in general, I would just let them, you know, be able to do that.
I remember the first game you weren't in charge, but the way to Worcester and you sat in the stand and watched it. What was your impressions? What was going through your mind at that point, knowing that, you know, you're in charge of these players that are in front of you now?
Yeah, so, you know, I went to Worcester and I looked at the squad, and they had some good players. You know, they had Sam Brookley, Clark, there was Jack Parkinson, Fazza, Tony Finn, I think, played that day. So there was a good bulk of players, and I watched it and I thought, you know what, they're not. They was in the lower half of the South, I think, struggling a little bit. And I thought, I think they're better than that. I think they can finish in the top half. And I come away and I said, yeah, do you know what? I think I'm looking forward to going into training next week. And, you know, we made a couple of adjustments further down the line, but I felt that squad was good enough to, without changing it, to finish in the top half, and just needed maybe a fresh face and a fresh voice to just maybe, you know, get a couple more percent out of them than they were playing now.
You mentioned Tony said that you were too young at Dartford to go into management. Did you have that from a lot of people? Question why you did it then?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of people said to me, you know, it is a young age, and it's a make sure you get good staff around you, make sure you get people that you can trust. But if it's something you want to do, then go and do it. You know, you're never going to know. So there's no point in 5 years' time saying, I wish I would have took that job. That job was there. Some people said, I don't think you're ready, and I think that you're too young. And then others will give it a go. You know, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. You know, then just go back playing.
And did it help that you got off to a good start as well in terms of getting results?
Yeah, I think any manager wants to win the first game or the first couple of games, because I think that sets you up. And when you don't, other clubs I didn't. And that first game we won, I think it was a good win. And we went on a bit of a run. And I think, you know, for the first 4 or 5 games, we was unbeaten. And I think that helps. That builds confidence, momentum. People start believing in what you're coaching and what you're telling them, and then you can build from there.
4 years in a row in Conference South, you improved your league position year on year. How did you find the process of recruitment? Because as much as you'd observe coaches, that's probably something new to you in terms of which players am I going to go out and sign, and who have I got to let go?
Yeah, so I mean, if I'm honest, when I first took the job, I probably couldn't have told you any players in the Conference South where I'd dropped out and gone to the Ryman Premier. I knew there were some players at Dartford that I would like to have signed, but that was never going to happen. You know, we didn't have a particularly great budget at Welling. So the first year was about working with the players that we had, me identifying the players that I wanted to keep for the second season. And then as we was going through that season, I would go out and watch games, and I would make notes of teams we played against and players that I liked. And then I would try and sign some of them players for the following season, and then build that, you know, booklet up of players to continue that over the years.
Do you feel you got most of your recruitment right?
I think at Welling, the recruitment was good. We got a lot of good players on cheap money. Might have been lucky as well, I don't know. But I think at Welling, recruitment was good. But we was in a good catchment area. We had good links with, you know, Bournemouth, Millwall, Charlton, Gillingham. We had some good loan players from them clubs as well, which helped. And I think that for them years at Welling, the recruitment was good.
What were the best deals that you felt you were able to get done in terms of bringing people into the club?
One, obviously, too early on was Pewey. You know, we had Pewey on loan and he'd done exceptionally well, and I wanted to sign Pewey after the loan, and he went back to Gillingham, and he was a player that I could see that he probably needed to drop down to have a good couple of years, and then I felt he would move back on. And when him and Louis Cumbers, we signed them both together, and they was done exceptionally well. But I think Pewey come here, he was focused, he done extra training, he was still in that professional sort of mode. And, you know, for me, one of my earlier best signings, you know. And like Pires, to be fair, the first year that he played at Welling, I watched him at Leighton Orient, and he was 6'4", very skillful, quite strong. And his first season as well, we done it exceptionally well. And I think as you move on, you know, Fraser Franks for the money that we was paying him for a player like that to play for us was fantastic. Ross Lafayette, Harry Buterman, Alex Dyer was a fantastic signing. I thought he was a very good player. We didn't have him very long. He moved on to Sweden. But again, you know, and you look at players like Jake Gallagher, who we signed, you know, been released from Millwall, took him in, and what he's turned on to. And I suppose, you know, I can't really... Joe Ely was... You know, I played against Joe for Margate, and I always he just put something in the back of my mind that I wanted to sign him one day. And, you know, when he became available, I think he was playing for Beckenham. I think, you know, I've listened to Pewey's thing. He's probably one of the best players that I've coached and worked with. He just, if he had that drive, he should be playing in the league, or he should have played in the league. But he was just happy doing what he was doing.
You joke about getting players on the cheap, but making the numbers add up relative to your own club's budget is a big thing for a manager, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to. We didn't have a big budget at Welling, and you had to work within that budget. And you had to make sure that you got the right player that fitted into the budget, but fitted into what you wanted to do as a squad. You know, you didn't want to affect the squad. We had a great bunch of lads from all four years, really. And they was all on a set amount of money. There was no one that was on a lot more than anyone else. It was all matter of much. We had younger players that made the bench up, but they knew they had an opportunity to do well. And yeah, it was. We managed to get that right, and I think on and off the pitch we got it right at Welling.
You mentioned Andy Pugh there. He obviously came in and done a podcast with us earlier on in the season. He talked about the time when the club had the tax bill, £100,000, and the fans raised £60,000 plus of it to help save the club at the time. And he said he didn't know how Jamie Day kept the squad together and kept everything going. So, Neil, you're here. How did you keep everything going?
Yeah, I mean, for one, obviously the fans played a massive part in that club still being here. You know, without people doing what they did, we wouldn't have had a club. And I think, you know, at the time, we had younger players that were playing to try and get back into the league, so they wasn't on big money, and my job was to, you know, try and keep them to look at the bigger picture, that they were playing at Welling, we were doing fairly well, they were in the shop window, you know, they were confident, they were playing regularly, and I half was hoping, half knew that the money would come at some stage, so my job was to just keep them going for as long as I possibly could, and people not saying, I've had enough now, I want to leave. So we tried to keep the environment positive, we tried to keep it fun, and it helps when you're winning games. And I think everyone bought into that and knew that what I was saying was truthful, it was honest. You know, if the wages weren't going to come, then I would say to them, it's not this week, you'll definitely get it next week. And they definitely got it next week, so they could believe and trust what I was saying. And that's why I think we kept them all together, because they knew that it was going to turn at some stage and they wanted to stick with it until it did.
How close were any of the players to leaving from that squad?
Yeah, we had a couple. I remember having a couple of discussions with players, and you know, I was like, look, if I can't, I've got bills, and everyone has bills at non-league level, and you know, I need to get paid next week, or I need to have some sort of money coming in. And we managed to find it, and we borrow off someone, and we do that, and we just done our best to keep everyone happy. And if someone knew that if they were short, they could come to me and ask, and I would do my best to get them some money and all of their wages if we could.
Did you wonder what you'd let yourself in for at that point?
Probably at the time, but then I think no course in the world could prepare me for what happened that season. 5 points deducted, you know, transfer embargo, tax bill, you know, and that's how you learn, and that's how you learn to speak to people and deal with situations other than sitting in a room in a course, you know. So for me, it was a good learning curve for me to deal with that. If it ever happened again, I'd hopefully know what to do and how to act.
But at the end of the season, you just missed out on the playoffs. How much did that hurt?
Yeah, that was very disappointing for me, because we've been in the playoffs all year, and I think the last four or five games, I think we ran out of steam, if I'm honest. I think the squad was bare, and we just didn't have enough to get us into that playoffs, which was disappointing, because they, for what they'd done that season, they deserved to get in the playoffs, and then just to miss out, I think by a point, was disappointing. Yeah, I was disappointed with that.
The following campaign, you got to the playoffs, but you played Dartford in the final.
Yeah.
What's your memories of that day now?
Yeah, the memories of Dartford game is we didn't play particularly well, and Dartford scored early on, and then we never really done enough to get back into the game. I don't think we threatened enough. I think we had spells where we had possession of the ball, but we didn't create enough chances. And I think probably whoever would have scored first in that game would have won the game, because I think it was that there was two teams that were evenly matched, and I was, again, disappointed, because I thought we'd done well enough in the season to get promoted. But when it's an old club, and Tony, I knew all the players at Dartford as well, you know, so if I was going to lose to a team, I'd rather lose to Dartford, where I knew people there. And I think we had a good season, and in the end, I'm glad that Dartford went up because of the people that I knew at the club, and, you know, that we just moved on to the next season.
Not a bad season, the title-winning campaign. At what point did you think you could win that league?
I didn't at the start. You know, at the start of the season, we didn't have a great start, and I think we was like 9th or 10th in the league. And we had a meeting. I remember we had a meeting, and we just said a few home truths, that we weren't performing, and that the players that I had been fantastic for me before, and they needed to raise their game again. And then we played Maidenhead, and, you know, we was one up, and then second half we just collapsed, you know. And then we had a very good meeting in the dressing room after, you know, it was a long time, and, you know, I said a few things that I felt, and so did the staff. And then, credit to the boys, you know, we won 12 games on the spin, which is a league record, so they responded in the right way, and that set us up to win the league.
Were you surprised that you had that sort of dressing room dress down almost, that, you know, it came to that point? Did you think that was in you to do that?
Yeah, I think as you get older, you mellow out more. I think at the start, I'd always felt as a manager that I didn't like to be constantly shouted at. I felt that there was times when you need to shout and there's times where you need to put your arm around players. And early on, I probably shouted more than I do now, or definitely do now. And that time was needed. That time was... I didn't feel the players were letting me down because they were a fantastic bunch of boys, but I felt we weren't performing to levels that I know we could do. And they just needed to be reminded of how good they are, but that they wasn't reaching the levels that I wanted and what they're capable of. And then, say, they turned it around and went on a fantastic run.
Was it a teacup discussion? Where did they get thrown around?
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, I don't know if it was teacups, but there might have been a few bottles kicked and, you know, bags kicked and stuff like that. And to be fair to the boys, they took it on the chin. You know, no one ever questioned me shouting at them or ever, you know, answered back. They sat there for however long we was in there, took it on board, and, you know, there was many in that dressing room. You know, some of the times they could manage it themselves, but they knew that they weren't performing to what I wanted. And like I say, they all took it and they not proved me wrong because I wanted them to do well, but they, you know, said, look, we can do it. It's what we're capable of doing.
You went on that 12-game winning run. What was that like in the middle of that run? And it wasn't just 1-0, was it? Because you scored 32 goals during those 12 games. So you were properly putting sides away.
Yeah, I think in that run, we didn't feel we'd get beat. You know, we were going into games not worried about anyone. We were just going in there knowing that we had a group of players that would win. And there was lots of games. I remember Truro, I think we were 3-3 down at half-time, or 3-1 down, and we come back and won 4-3. You know, we had a little bit of luck as well. We played Basingstoke and they missed the penalty in the last minute at the post. But the boys just knew that they didn't fear anyone. That whoever we played, we was going to win. And that was the confidence right throughout the squad. If anyone dropped out, someone come in, they just come in and they kept that going. And yeah, I felt at that time that we wasn't going to get beat. I mean, even when we lost the run at Dover, we went one up and I thought, you know, we'll go on and continue and they come back and beat us. But through that time and after that Maidenhead game, I felt that, you know, we could win more games than lose.
After that, you had the sort of the race for the title, you and Salisbury going for it. How did you get over the line?
Yeah, I think, you know, me and Darryl spoke a lot in that season, and they had a very good team and they had some good players there. And I think that just after that run, I think they lost a little bit of confidence from it. And when you're in a title race and the other team keeps winning, it does have an effect. It does, you know, mentally drain you a little bit. And I think that run, you know, drained Salisbury a little bit. And then we managed to keep that going. Even when we got beat, we'd bounce back, you know, with a win or a draw. We never really went two or three games, you know, where we'd lose. We managed to get that back. And I think in the end, we just wore them down.
And what was it like final day to win and to lift the trophy and to celebrate?
Yeah, I think, you know, the game at Boreham Wood, you know, will always be a highlight for me. You know, I think we had to draw to win the league. And again, the boys, you know, done that task. And for a club that had very small budget for that league, with a group of players to perform like they did for the whole course of that season, was fantastic achievement and one that, you know, I'll never forget and be very proud of.
What was it like taking Welling up into the conference then and taking on the big boys?
Yeah, I think we knew it was going to be tough. You know, what we did do is we went to three mornings to try and make sure we was more organised and we was a little bit fitter and prepare us better for playing full-time teams. And the first season, I think any team that gets promoted, I think the first season you're still on the high from the season before. Players are still full of confidence and it's all new experience to them. And we started the season really well. I think towards the end we faded away a little bit and we dropped down. But it was a very good first season playing at stadiums, you know, league stadiums, with not playing in front of 300 people. There was 3,000 people, 4,000 people. So I think everyone was lifted by that and it was really good year, really enjoyed it. And then it's the second season where you need to sign players and you need to then progress again if you want to stay in that league. If you don't, then you end up, you know, coming out of it.
Does it start to catch up with you just because of the quality of those teams?
Yeah, I think, you know, just definitely the second season, teams work you out. They know how you play now. And for you then as a part-time club, you have to make sure recruitment is really good and you have to try and attract the right players to keep you in that league. It's not about how can you, for a team like Welling, it wasn't about are we going to get in the playoffs, are we going to get in the top 10. It was about can we stay up that was the aim, and that was what we tried to build at the start of the season. It was about us finishing as high as we can. If it was fifth from bottom, no problem. You know, as long as we could do that, we'd achieved what we wanted to do. And it is tough for part-time teams. I think if you look now, all the teams near the bottom of the team, the league, sorry, are part-time, and you need to make that transition into full-time football if you want to progress and go further.
When you was at Welling, there was an amazing incident that happened pre-season, I guess, wasn't it? Just before the start of one of the seasons, when they were approached by the bookmaker Paddy Power. Tell us about that tale.
Yeah, so if I remember it rightly, we was approached by Paddy Power, and what they wanted to do was they wanted us to put famous footballers on the back of our shirts for that season. So we'd just been promoted to the conference. So what they wanted was each player would be given a player, so Maradona, Messi, Ronaldo, and that player would wear that shirt for that season. And there was a figure that would be given to the club, and I think to the players for doing that. So we spoke to the players, and some of them were not interested in it whatsoever. They thought that it was, you know, a mockery of getting up and what we'd done, and to put Gerd Müller on the back of his shirt or them names. And then there were some that were interested in doing it because they thought it'd be good publicity for them, for the club, and going forward. So we looked into it, and we had a discussion about it. And then I think what come about of it was we had to actually change our names by deed poll. We had to go in and be called, change our name to Messi. So obviously that was like, no one was going to do that. And then it sort of stopped. And I think they looked at maybe doing the stadium and stuff like that. And I think they went to Farnborough in the end. But yeah, it was interesting because, you know, we did think about it and we thought it'd be good publicity. But when it got to actually having to change a name to that player, then it was never going to happen.
Had you been allocated player names by that point? Who was you going to become?
So I think I was going to be Bobby Robson. I think that's who I was going to be. And obviously keeper was going to be Gordon Banks, and there was just a whole range of older players, which was quite funny, but obviously it didn't work out.
For the latest reaction and reports from the games that matter, visit our website at kentonline.co.uk.
When you were in the second season then in the Premier, Ebbsfleet came calling, didn't they? Was it something that you had to think about?
Yeah, I think I've always said I love being at Welling. I feel at home. I feel that you know, it just suits me, Welling. But I felt that I got to a stage of Welling that the budget wasn't going to improve. We were going to get relegated at some stage, whether it was the following season, the season after. It was going to happen. And I'd spoke to Ebbsfleet. Obviously, I knew that they had a very good budget. I knew that there was a club that were trying to get up. And if they got up, they had the finances to go further. So for me, it was an opportunity to, even though to drop down, I think it was an opportunity that I felt would be a good one to take. If I did get him promoted, then we'd be in a good position to stay in that league and then progress further.
It's fair to say you packed a lot in to a short time at Ebbsfleet. How do you reflect that period?
I think disappointed. I think that's a little. I was bitter a little bit after it finished, but it was a strange scenario actually. When I look back on it, it was. There was things that were promised that didn't happen, and I didn't get things right either as well. It wasn't just, you know, I'm not blaming the club. It was me as well, going from somewhere that I'd been liked as a manager to somewhere that probably I wasn't liked, and I didn't know how to deal with that as well. So,
what, by fans?
Yeah, I think, listen, I'm not blaming every fan at Ebbsfleet, because I met some really nice people at Ebbsfleet. You know, all the staff in the office, Peter Danzy, Maggie, they were fantastic to me. I felt at Ebbsfleet that even if we won, there were certain people that wasn't ever happy, and I didn't know how to react to that. You know, I'd never had that before. I'd never had people shouting at me and screaming abuse at me, and I didn't deal with it very well. I think, you know, that's in now. It was good for me to have that, because if it happens again, like I said before, then you learn from it. But at that time, it was a combination of emotions. I wanted to do really well there. I knew that there was the tools to do well. There was things that affected that off the pitch, you know, and ultimately you have to get results on it as well. And the whole combination of it just didn't really work for me, unfortunately.
There was quite a big turnover of players, wasn't there? Quite a few left the club. I think about a dozen came in while you were there. Is that one of the things when you mean, you know, perhaps you didn't quite get it right?
Yeah, I think that you know, when I first met Ebbsfleet to have a chat, I looked at the squad and I remember saying that the chairman wasn't there, he was on a voice call sort of thing, and I looked at the squad and I said, look, I still feel this squad can get promoted. I think there was fifth in the league and we'd played a couple more games, but and I looked at it and I looked at the squad and I said to him, and I remember saying it, you know, I can get this squad of players will get promoted. And you know, I remember that the first couple, we lost the first game, and I said to you before, you know, when you lose the first game, it's disappointing because you want to go on a run. And then we beat well in the next game, and I remember we played, and I wanted to give these boys a chance because I felt they were good enough, and we had a couple of okay results, and then we got beat 5-0 by Basingstoke, and the chairman was over that game, and I remember the next day, that evening, I got a phone call. Said you need to be up London to see the chairman. I was thinking, it's like third or fourth game. I can't be getting sacked already after yeah. four games. So I went up to meet him in London, and he basically said, look, you know, I've seen the players you've got now over the last 18 months, whatever it is, they're not good enough. You need to get rid of them, and you need to bring in league players. And I said to him at the time, I said, look, it will work two ways. Either if we get league players in, they're going to be players that aren't playing in the league clubs that they're at, so that's going to have an effect. And to put a completely new squad together, it will either hit the ground running or we're not going to hit the ground running. And he said, no problem. That's what I want. So I said, OK, no problem. And I think looking back, I should have signed one or two. And I should have kept the boys that we had for momentum to go into the end of the season and then reevaluate again at the end of the season. But we made a massive change. And I felt we signed some good players. Tom Bonner. You know, Fishy was at Gillingham, Stuart Lewis was at Wickham, we signed Keds, we signed Cunnington, we signed Shields. You know, when you look at them players, they're good players, especially for dropping down. And you know, I think for me, I knew it would take time for them to settle in the Conference South because it's completely different football to what they're used to. And I knew that they might not hit the ground running. But I also, from my point of view, is I felt good players, but I didn't sign players that fitted into getting the best 11 out there. You know, when I look back, I think Keds and Cunnington probably couldn't play together up front. You know, at the time, I'd signed both of them, so I wanted to play them, and we were spending good money on both of them. So you don't want to sign someone and then go, oh, no, actually, you're on the bench when he signed from League Two. So that combination probably didn't work, even though I think Keds got a good goal ratio, and I think Adam Cunnington scored 8 in 15 games for me, but that combination probably didn't work. Matt Godden got pushed out to the right. You know, and then for me, you know, while that was happening, I think the one regret I have as well is I think I said something after the Bromley game about the older players. And it's nothing to do with the older players. It wasn't their fault. I wasn't having a go at them. I think I was frustrated. I think that I was disappointed with the way it was going at that time. And I think it was easy for me to say, oh, it's the older players. It was nothing to do with that. I think that the older players that left, I had no problem with, no issues. They were as good as gold to me. They trained well. I think the problems we had was the transition. We was meant to get rid of players with the new players coming in, and we got rid of one or two. And I remember turning to training one day, and we had like 36 players training. And, you know, I looked at my, like Ash and Frosty, and I was like, there's too many people here. You know, we can only keep 11 happy. And like I say, none of them was ever a problem with me. They trained, you know. But when you're a player that's not playing, after two or three games, you want to play. And we had so many players that, you know, I remember Peter coming to me and saying, right, I think you're going to have to train some in the afternoon and some in the morning. But then that would have been a bigger issue because the ones that trained in the afternoon knew they had completely no chance of ever playing. And then basically do that and then meet up on a Saturday and everyone will be hunky-dory and, you know, so it just, the whole combination now, when I look back, it wasn't going to work. It was, if we was going to do the transition, you needed a squad of 18 and then the rest, whoever they was, had to be shipped out and they had to go. And we didn't do that. And then that causes, you know, problems. And I remember looking up one day in a game and we had like 17 players in the stand. And I'm thinking, that's not right. It doesn't matter who's in charge, I think. You can't manage 36 players and keep them happy. And, yeah, I think me and Pete had some differences, and I think the final sort of straw came was I wanted to pick a player for a game, and he didn't want to because his agent had been on the phone. And I picked him, and we won, and he scored. And we never spoke after that. And that was, you know, probably about 6 weeks before I got sacked. And I knew from then on, we won that game, and I see Pete, and Pete see me, and he just nodded. And then we literally spoke by text for 6 weeks. So in the back of my mind, I knew that it wasn't right. There was a little bit of trying to fix it with one of the other directors, but it never really got back to where it was. And then I was, if I'm honest, I was waiting to get sacked. You know, I knew that it was coming. I wasn't sure when it was going to be, but just behind the scenes, we didn't click, and we had different ideas. Looking back, I should have just brought in a couple of players. I should have done it how I'd done it at Welling. I should have, you know, give the players an opportunity. And yeah, that's disappointment. I think, you know, I was told that, don't worry about this season now with the transition, just worry about next season. If you don't start the season well, then you might get sacked then. And that's how I believed it was going to be. But obviously, with all the ongoings, it just didn't happen, and we ended up, you know, going separate ways.
In hindsight, without doubt, the best signing that you made was Keds, looking at what he's done for the club since then. Were you surprised, though, that you were able to get him in, because he was playing in League One at the time?
Yeah, and, you know, I think for the club to sign someone like Keds was a massive signing, and he wasn't cheap, and we knew that. But, you know, I managed to attract him to Ebbsfleet, and like you say, I think for what he's done over the last years he's been there, he's been a fantastic servant and been one of their best players, you know. So, you know, I even look at, you know, Stuart Lewis. I think the year after I went, he won Player of the Year and had a really good season. So, but like I say, I think if you look at Keds and see what he's done, then, you know, I'm pleased that I managed to get him in.
After leaving Ebbsfleet, you worked with AD Pennock again, didn't you, a couple of times. You mentioned that your paths crossed for the first time at Welling. He was an influential person for you. That's been an important part of your career, isn't it, working with him?
Yeah, I think when I left Ebbsfleet, I think it knocked my confidence for a good period of time. I think when I've managed before, you don't think you're going to get sacked. You know, you never get. When I first started coaching at Welling, I didn't even think about severance pay or think about win ratios or think about, you know, getting sacked. Then when you get sacked, it did hit me, and AD called me and said, look, why don't you just come in, you know what I'm like, why don't you come in with me, work as number twos, less pressure, you can do the coaching.
This was Forest Green.
This is Forest Green, you can do the coaching, I think we'll work well together, we both know how we want to play and what you want to do, and take some time out from being a manager, come and, you know, learn off him as well as a manager, and come down to a really nice club, really nice area. Why don't you do that for a while? And that was the first time that I moved away from home. So I wasn't sure, first of all. I'd never left my children and family. But it was a good decision. I thoroughly enjoyed the year that I was there.
It was what you needed, maybe, to come out of the spotlight a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Because, like I say, I don't, if I'm honest, I don't know if I could have managed again straight away and been good enough to manage straight away again and go straight back into it. Mentally, I was struggling a little bit because I was so disappointed that I'd been sacked and that it hadn't worked out, and I was still working out why it hadn't worked out and what I hadn't done right and why I'd maybe been treated the way I had been treated by certain people at the club. I couldn't get it all right, and I think that was, you know, for me to go as number two for a while was very good.
I've read in an interview that you've done somewhere else that you were talking about how difficult it is for coaches to get opportunities in the Football League, you know, to go from non-league to become a manager in the league. The chance that you did have was working alongside AD again, wasn't it, at Gill's. Do you reflect on that period, and would you still sort of stand by that it is difficult for coaches to kind of break in?
Yeah, I think AD had a tough job when he first went into Gillingham, and you want the opportunity to manage in the league or coach in the league. So when it come up, it was a lot less money than we was getting in non-league. You know, but it was the opportunity to manage in the league, and we felt that if you did get it right, like anything, then it could lead to other things. So it wasn't a risk. It was, you know, something we wanted to do. But then I think when we got in there, I think it was a lot bigger job than Aid had imagined it was going to be. And, you know, we both found it tough to start with, because I think in the league, players are different. I think they have a different mentality, and I think they're a bit more ruthless. And Aid had to get some players out to try and even the camp up again and make it a happy camp. And, you know, I think we stayed up and that was the objective, but we probably should have done it a lot sooner than we did. I think it was down to the last game and we're waiting for another result. And I think, you know, but I do think that Aid wasn't helped with the group of players at that time. Not all of them, because I still speak to a lot of them now, but there are one or two that just didn't help that situation. And I enjoyed working in the league. Would I do it again? I don't know. I want to be ambitious, but I think you need to pick the right club and you need to pick the right chairman and you need to pick a number of factors to do that. I wouldn't just go, I'll take that job now just because it's in the league. Whereas I would have done that before. I would have gone, oh yes, league club, I'm taking it.
So what happened at Jules kind of opened your eyes a bit?
Yeah, definitely. And I loved working with them players because they are technically a step up. You know, you tell them once and they do it. And you can do different things, different training. And so I love that side of it. And for me, I was a little bit lucky. I didn't have to deal with chairman. I didn't have to deal with the press, really, or any of them things that have a factor in being a manager. I just coached and give my opinion to Aid and he would say yes, no, or whatever we would do. So I was a little bit away from that, but I think it was a tough job for Aid. And, you know, that the second season, Aid didn't know he was going to get the job until 2 weeks before the season. And for him to continue working in the summer every day, not knowing if he had that job or not, because he wanted that club to do well, just shows what character he is. And I look now and he signed Thomas Holy in goal, Gab Zaguani at the back, Connor Ogerville, Luke O'Neill, Tom Eaves. You know, he signed some good players on not a lot of money because there was no money, there was no budget. I think, you know, in the summer they spoke to two other managers and they turned it down because they wanted double the budget. And Aid still continued to work and be professional. And then, unfortunately, you know, we didn't start as well as we would have liked to in that league, and we paid the price for it.
In your opinion, then, not just relating to what happened at Jules, but all the clubs that you've been at, how influential is, you know, what happens, the atmosphere within those four walls of the changing room to what happens out on the pitch?
Yeah, I think any manager or coaches, you need to have the group of players in that dressing room on your side. They need to believe in what you're doing. They need to trust what you're doing. And if they don't, then that reflects all around. That reflects, you know, on the pitch, the training ground. And you need to get a group of players that you can trust, that you can leave in that dressing room, you can walk away and you know that you can trust them players. And that takes time. You can't do that in 5 months, one season. It's a build-up of players. You work out the players that you like and their mentalities and who you like and who you're not sure on. And sometimes it's just you don't click with a manager and you don't click with a player and they move on, no problem. But it takes time for that to work everyone out and see how they perform on the pitch and if they can carry out what you want them to do. And then that's how you make your decisions.
What would your advice be for someone, a player maybe 29, 30, kind of in your shoes when you were at Dartford and thinking, yeah, I might like a go at managing in my career? What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think, you know, from my first experience, I had a very good experience. So I would say straight away, go and do it. I think if you have an idea or an ambition of wanting to be a coach, manager, player coach, then an opportunity comes up that a club that you like, you know, then I would suggest, you know, give it a go. And where you are lucky at that age is if it doesn't work out, then you can go back playing. You've got that fallback. Whereas if you're a manager and you don't get your first job right, it could affect a number of jobs further down the line. So for me, I think my advice would be, you know, always give it a go as a player coach at young age. I think it's worth doing and you don't want to have any regrets of not doing it.
On to the quickfire questions, Jamie. Best goal you ever scored in your career?
I'll probably say I scored a goal against Crawley, Dover v Crawley in Southern Premier, which was a volley from about 25 yards. So I'll probably say that one was in the best one.
Favourite ground that you played at?
Wembley, I think, would be the best one that I've played at.
Best game that you've played in, if you could go back and experience those 90 minutes again?
Yeah, I think for me, obviously, the best game I would say is Boreham Wood, not because of the result or just the fact of what was at that game after it was winning the league, and that was something that I wanted to achieve.
You mentioned some of the players you signed, but who was your best signing during your management days that you ever made?
I'll say Joe Healy because of how good I know he can be and how many games he won and type of player of his quality.
But before you had him, was he more of a striker than a midfielder?
Yeah, Joe was a forward, and then, you know, he wasn't quick enough to be a forward. He could drop in number 10, but I think that he could see a pass and he was very good at keeping the ball and he could create. So we dropped him wider and sometimes played centre mid. But fantastic player. I just wish he would have done more.
Who's the best player you've played against?
I think from a kid, you know, we played Brazil and Ronaldinho played and we played at Wembley and he was an unbelievable player at 15, 16, whatever it was. And I'll never forget playing against him as being the best player that I've ever played against. I think from non-league point of view, Dave Rainford was always a very hard opponent to play against, very big, strong, good player. I never really played well against him, and I think that was because, obviously, you know, at that time, he was better than me.
Jamie, time beats us once again. We could chat for quite a long time, I would have thought, and discuss your schoolboy days and all the players that ended up being much better than you in the end. But we won't do that. But thanks for coming in. Thanks for the insight. I mean,
thanks for having us.
Being so honest and talking about the various roles and the difficulties that and the successes that you've had during your career. Wish you well with Bangladesh in the future.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in to see us.
Cheers. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the KM Football Podcast. Click subscribe at Audio Boom and iTunes and keep up to date with the latest stories at kentonline.co.uk.